Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. And today, my special guest is Frank Fotios-Tsimbukaikas. Frank is the Democratic candidate running for state Senate against incumbent Republican Senator Joel Anderson in the 38th State Senate District. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here and express my views.
We should add, we're also extending an invitation to Senator Anderson as well, and we're hoping to start a series of issue-oriented talks on the show where we invite in candidates in the different races to talk about the issues that matter most to our listeners here in East County. So, Frank, if you could start by introducing yourself, tell us a little bit about your background and what made you decide to run for office.
Well, I decided to run for this particular office last year on March 21st. When the final hearing at the CPUC in Kearny Mesa was held regarding the Santee Power Plant.
The Quail Brush Power Plant.
Correct.
You're talking about the California Public Utilities Commission that held a hearing on that very controversial issue.
Correct. And I was opposing it along with most of the people in Santee, in Allied Gardens, and around Mission Trails Park.
Yeah, for those that may not be familiar with it, this is a gas-powered, fossil fuel-powered peaker power plant that was proposed right next to Mission Trails Regional Park and schools, and it was opposed by not only the Republican mayor of Santee, but by the Democratic mayor of San Diego and many other prominent elected officials. So where was Joel Anderson on that issue, Frank?
He was absent. Diane Jacob was there, and she spoke against it. Duncan Hunter sent a letter in opposition.
So our supervisor, our congressman.
So did Brian Jones.
All Republicans, yeah.
Jack Dale, a council member and past mayor of Santee, was there and spoke against it.
Right, and of course, then Democratic Mayor Bob Filner from San Diego as well.
And Joel Anderson was absent, so I was shocked, especially considering it was basically going to be built across from West Hills High School, which is right in the middle of his territory.
I don't recall him ever taking a stand at all, not only being absent at one hearing, but he never sent a letter in opposition?
Correct. They read the names of all the politicians, legislators that had sent letters in opposition that couldn't be present, and his name was never announced. Researching it further, I found out that the same was the case with the East County Powerlink that was built, that he never expressed an opinion for or against.
Sunrise Powerlink?
Correct.
That was the one that Supervisor Jacob warned was, she called it a severe and unmitigatable fire hazard, and she was extremely outspoken about the dangers that that project posed to East County.
Correct. And then I went, and I never thought of running for office. I was satisfied being the VP of the East County Democratic Club, doing my charitable work and going about my business. And then after further researching Joel Anderson, I realized he was the least communicating senator in the state and the least communicating legislator in the area.
Now, when you say that, in all fairness, I mean, he does send newsletters and stuff out to his constituents. When you say least communicating, are you talking about making public appearances, or what is your standard?
Holding meetings where someone does not really have to go out of their way to find them, to speak with them.
So town hall meetings, that sort of thing?
Correct. All I noticed was, in the 4.5 years I've been in East County, I got his invitations for his Christmas party. Before they'd come in cards last year, they actually came in an email, which is fine. But I didn't see any open houses advertised. Brian Jones had 2 or 3 open houses where community members were invited to go. Duncan Hunter has held some meetings, and he's gone to groups speaking on Labor Days or Memorial Days or July 4th. I looked online for any comments on any issues. I didn't find any. So that was it.
So apart from the Quail Brush power plant, the issue of energy issues overall, now I know that I've talked to some of the senator's constituents out in the rural areas of East County. where these massive wind farms, industrial-scale solar farms, are transforming, you know, the face of East County, truly. And a lot of them have told me they've contacted him and that he has not spoken out to take a stand against those issues either, or for that matter, for it, that he's kind of just not said much. So it begs the question, Frank, of what are your views? Obviously, you're against power plants. I know you've said that for gas-powered power plants, you don't think they should be in city limits. But for the rural listeners out there that are concerned about the industrialization of East County through the big wind and solar projects, what are your views on those?
Well, I am the person that believes a rooftop solar in every house. Mm-hmm. I have presented recommendations twice to the Board of Supervisors that are in opposition to any solar or wind farms out there.
So you have actually taken a position on record,
yes,
against these industrial-scale projects.
Yes. The county has made a good faith effort to work with renewable energy, so I give them credit for that. However, they're geared towards working with aggregators, and aggregators are people that produce energy, mm-hmm, clean energy, and then they sell it.
Yeah.
They sell it to local constituents. So what we have is we have cleaner energy produced. However, we're not losing the dependency problem. We're going from being dependent on SDG&E to being dependent on another small investor-owned company that's producing mass energy.
Right.
What's worse with that is that energy to be produced needs to be in farms, large solar projects that are amongst fire hazard areas, that they're windmills in mass quantities that create noises. And it's not even about the issue of risking the lives of birds and natural life. It's about actually risking the lives of humans that live in the area.
Yeah, very serious concern. Now, I've always thought it very odd that Senator Anderson did not take a stand, as you've noted, with these wind farms. You know, Duncan Hunter has written letters against them. We've seen Bob Filner, when he was in Congress, was taking stands against them. Vargas is working right now, Congressman Vargas, with some of his constituents to try to address some of their concerns about the wind farm in Ocotillo. And yet Senator Anderson has been very silent on this issue. So it does beg the question. We've looked at some of his financial contributions. He does seem to have gotten many significant contributions from SDG&E. SDG&E was one of the several organizations that he got in trouble for accepting donations that had been funneled through two Republican central committees to his campaign. He had to give those back, and he was fined $20,000 by the FPPC for that. And
to return about $148,000.
I haven't looked recently, but how much money has he taken lately from SDG&E,
well,
if any?
We all had to file a report for fundraising for the first period of the year from January 1 to March 17th. So I looked and compared my fundraising, which was a measly $5,000, to Joe Anderson's $25,750, of which $25,750 were from organizations and companies and none
from
an individual.
100% of it is from corporations.
Correct.
And zero is from individuals.
There was a non-monetary donation of around $47 that I don't know where it came from. My donations were from myself and from four constituents. That's more than Joe Anderson received.
Yeah, so he's basically not been willing to take a stand against these energy projects, and he's getting money from SDG&E. So we'll leave constituents, I guess, or listeners to draw a judgment about whether there's a connection there, and we certainly will be asking him about that if he comes on the show, in all fairness. Perhaps he has other reasons for not taking a stand on these things. Now, to switch gears for just a moment, Frank, one of the most interesting issues that you raised in this campaign that I had not heard before, but as a parent of two recent college graduates, I know myself and my intern here from SDSU has been very fascinated about your proposal for how to make college more affordable. Can you tell us about your plan?
Yes, I think and I aim to eliminate tuition for California undergraduate residence students.
We're talking about
in
both
the UC system, the CSU system, and the community college system. This will involve saving money to about 2.5 million students, which would correspond to maybe 2.5 million families at least.
Now, I'm sure the students, and speaking as a parent, I'm sure would be delighted if it was possible to have this happen, because obviously there's a lot of people who can't afford to go to college, or it's, you know, just breaking the parents to put them through. But that said, Some people may think that's unrealistic. Where does the money come from? The state has been cash strapped. How do you get the money to support the fine quality educational institutions we have in California if you eliminate tuition for California resident students?
Well, I looked, I started by looking at what the budget used to be and what it is. In 1981, when I first attended UC Berkeley, the UC system was getting 5.06% of the state budget's money, and this is only one system. Today, they get 2.86%. That 2.2% difference at $150 billion budget corresponds to over $3 billion. The gap, which is the tuition that's actually paid by undergraduate students before any financial aid is calculated, is about $3.8 billion. And we're talking state residents, undergraduates that attend those institutions is less than $5 billion, less than $3 billion for the CSU and the UC system. Now, the CSU system is running like what I would say a well-oiled machine, very efficient for the number of campuses, 23, the number of employees, about 44,000. The UC system is a little overburdened with administrative personnel exceeding 132,000 as of 2012. For 10 campuses, that's 13,200 per campus. Some of them have more. UCLA is over 30,000. Santa Barbara is much more efficient. It's
so you're saying the answer basically in a nutshell is to cut the administrative? They're top heavy on administrative?
There is a few measures that have to be taken. First, my elimination of tuition will occur over 10 years. It will be a 10% a year deduction until it zeros out in 10 years. Mm-hmm. It will also apply to California longer-term residents. For example, you've been here 4 years, you're attending college, you get 4 years free tuition, 5 years free tuition. If you've been here 1 year, you come from another state, you graduate high school, after 1 year, normally you would be considered a resident. Now you can get 1 year free tuition. Mm-hmm. We need to reward long-term paying California taxpayers, citizens, the parents that put these roads together, that built these buildings to be rewarded first.
There you go.
It will also apply to 5 years of studying in combination, junior college or four-year college. We don't want to keep this going on forever. This will help expedite people through the system since they won't have to work as much to support themselves.
Yeah, my daughter was working 3 jobs at one point to get through UC and having to take the minimum units and work 3 jobs.
They won't have to borrow money. In addition, a big benefit to the state will be the money that the parents save from not having to pay the tuition will be pumped right back into the economy. Not everything will be saved. So there will be a tax benefit in tax sales revenue.
So if anything, this would be a net revenue benefit for the state, you believe.
Correct.
You
grow
drain.
Business. It's not. It's like a tax break for people, just like a lot of my other plans. They translate into being a tax benefit that benefits everyone.
I mean, you've obviously done a lot of research on this, and I understand, Frank, that your background actually is in finance. Can you tell people just a little bit about yourself and your avocation, your professional background?
So yeah, it's
your qualifications for this job.
I spend most of my career in sales and marketing, and 21 of those years was actually in the alcohol beer business. I have an MBA from National University.
Would you be willing to vote against measures that the alcohol industry was sponsoring today?
Yes, I think we can't look at who donates to us. We have to look at what the merits of a bill are. And we have to be realistic. We cannot be wishy-washy on certain issues. I prioritize my life. As I tell people, there's the two most important segments of our society are the under 18s and the over 65s. The over 65s because they're the ones who built this country, and the under 18s because they're the future of this country.
Okay. Back to your background a little bit. So you did a lot of sales and marketing.
Yes.
And then?
I worked as a investment banker, stockbroker, 86, 87, 88. Mm-hmm. I got out of the business. I got into beer sales and marketing, which my life led to it. I ran the campus bar in UC Berkeley when I was there. So it was a natural progression. And I worked for almost 21 years until my company was bought out, Anheuser-Busch, and I was laid off. And that was okay. I understood it. Fortunately, over time, I had built a nice nest egg with investments, being an experienced investor. Mm-hmm. I had built a nice nest egg of real estate investments. So I had planned for it and I was okay. And I was just going about working my business, raising my kids, you know, nurturing them as they're going through college and living life with my wife until I decided to be politically active. I paid attention and I said, you know what? We can do it better. We deserve the best. We deserve better than what we're getting, but we deserve the best in East County because, like Gavin Newsom said at a meeting last week, I think in California we've forgotten and we think that California is the first 15 miles from the coast. And there is an inland that needs to be tended to, and he was 100% right.
So you want to be the champion for those inland voters?
I want to be the champion for everybody because eliminating tuition in the state will save money to 2.5 million families. Maybe 50, 60,000 of those families are in my district. Doing some of the other proposals that I have will favor 300,000 residents in my area, 20,000. So in the end, 100% of the people will benefit. If we don't build any power plants in any rural areas where people live, guess what? Everybody benefits. We have cleaner air.
I want to ask you, circle back to another question on the energy issue. One thing that I was pretty surprised to find out is that although California has this very ambitious and I think commendable goal of saying let's get 30% of our power from renewable sources by 2030, I was rather shocked to find out that rooftop solar doesn't count toward that, and that when the regulators are considering, say, a project like the industrial Soitec solar project or these big wind projects out here, they are not allowed to say, well, let's look at an alternative of what would it cost if we took the same money and spent it on rooftop solar, how much could we produce? Solar experts have told me you could actually provide more power for less money if you just paid everybody to put solar on the roofs. They're only allowed by law to consider other industrial scale projects. Well, if we don't build this giant wind farm, we'll build another wind farm, you know, down the road, another site. Do you think that legislation is needed in Sacramento to correct that, what many would say is an inequity there, and to instead encourage or require that the first choice should be the least environmentally destructive and the ones that will produce the most power for the least total cost, both dollar cost and environmental cost, and maybe require that things like rooftop solar be evaluated as an alternative to industrial scale projects?
Realistically, the most effective way to use renewable energy is one house, one solar. Mm-hmm. Every house to have their own independence in energy production. Usually this will translate to 25 years, and because of the savings, the time will come where everything will be renewed. It would go on automatic pilot once we do this. I think one of the reasons that individual solar systems in homes is not recognized because companies that have the solar farms tend to be a little better givers than individual homeowners may be.
So it's back to the money.
They're the ones who will pay for golf tournaments, for trips to seminars, for expensive dinners. And that's why I've said I will not take a dollar in gifts from anyone. I don't need them. I never took them when I was in sales, and I don't do them now because I don't return the favor. I try to be objective, and if you receive benefits, it's very hard to be objective.
Do you think that a bill is needed to require that alternatives to industrial scale be considered on a project-by-project basis? That, in other words, the regulators would be required to weigh rooftop solar or other small-scale distributed, locally produced projects over remote industrial scale wind or solar projects?
Yes, I would even carry a bill to do that, because what happens is a house with solar panels has just gone off the grid, right? Mm-hmm. So they're producing solar energy. The old days, it may have been the thought that it's easier to track big projects because they're concentrated. You know what? The way the system works today with these computers and the technology we have is very simple. We know exactly what went where, the companies that installed them, they know how much power went to each house. So technology makes things so much easier for us. I don't know why we don't use it for a lot of other things too.
Well, we are very appreciative of you taking the time to come on our show today, Frank, and we definitely hope to have you back along with Senator Anderson so that we can have some real in-depth conversations on the issues that matter most. And listeners, if there's an issue out there that you want us to ask the candidates about, please send us your questions to editor@eastcountymagazine.org, and we will do our best to get some answers.
Thank you for the opportunity to express my positions, and hopefully I have a lot of positions. I have an opinion on a lot of subjects, and I think it's a matter of taking action or not taking action, and I'm a guy of taking action. And everybody who's dealt with me in the past, they know that I don't like to mince my words. I care about the whole. I don't care the me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
You're welcome.
You are listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
I'm John Mattis, investigative guy, host of Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers, shining a light on shady deals all around us.
John Mattis has won 7 Emmy Awards, a Golden Mike, and the Edward R. Murrow Award for exposing fraud and corruption. Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers is produced by the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso. This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting the Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers segment on today's East County Magazine Show. You could call this scam a license to steal, and it certainly was, until it all came crashing down on the corrupt state employees and their accomplices who were selling California driver's licenses for cash. For at least 3 years, though, between 2009 and 2012, the scammers had a nearly seamless operation that netted a tidy profit right here in East County. Here's how it worked. A man who owned a driving school let his students know that, for a price, he could guarantee them a license, even if they had already failed the driving test. Often they didn't even have to take the test, thanks to this man's connections at the Department of Motor Vehicles, that's DMV, office in El Cajon. Those willing to pay anywhere from $500 to $2,500 to corrupt DMV employees could get a license with no questions asked. The driving school catered mostly to Middle Eastern immigrants, and soon word of easy licenses in that community spread north to Los Angeles and beyond. One guy flew in from Dallas, took a cab to the DMV office, paid for his license, and flew back to Dallas a few hours later, said Special Agent Mike Peters, who investigated the case with Special Agent Kim George out of the FBI's San Diego division. It was so blatant, Agent Peters said, that our surveillance showed the driving school operator brokering multiple deals right in the DMV parking lot. Court records indicate that the group, which included Kuvan Piamari, who owned the U.S. driving school in El Cajon, Jeffrey Bednarik, a DMV examiner who conducted driving tests, and 3 other DMV employees took part in the long-running bribery conspiracy that produced hundreds of ill-gotten licenses. Now, in exchange for bribes, Bednarik falsely entered passing scores for written and behind-the-wheel tests for applicants seeking regular and commercial driver's licenses. He enlisted other DMV employees to falsify records as well, and he produced over 100 fraudulent driver's permits, for which applicants paid a total of more than $50,000. Sometimes the corrupt DMV employees would issue multiple bogus licenses in a single day, Agent George said. They would leave work with $500 in cash in their pocket, and that could be one day a week or two. They were doing very well. When a new manager arrived at the El Cajon DMV office, however, she instantly realized that something wasn't right. The new manager alerted the DMV's investigative arm, who in turn called the FBI. Using undercover operatives and court-authorized surveillance and wiretaps, investigators quickly uncovered the scam. Some of the candidates who paid for the licenses were bad drivers, George explained, and some paid because they were just too lazy to take the test. Agent Peters added that some had paid for commercial licenses that allowed them to drive tanker trucks. That took things to a different level in terms of public safety, he said. In all, 30 defendants have been charged with conspiracy to commit bribery and identification document fraud, and all of them have pled guilty. The case is ongoing. Bednarik is scheduled to be sentenced in April. Another DMV employee, Jim Bean, was sentenced to 18 months in prison for his role in the scheme. Agent Peters said, "We hope this case sends a message. This type of corruption will not be tolerated." The investigation into widespread corruption and bribery at the El Cajon DMV office is still active. Anyone with information is asked to contact the FBI at 1-877-NO-BRIBE.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. This week's Destination East County program has some hot rods, hoofbeats, hoppin' good fun with the Easter Bunny, and a Sweet 16 party at the 16th Annual Morning Glory Brunch, served at St. Madeline's Sophie's campus on East Madison Avenue in El Cajon on Saturday, April 12th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. St. Madeline Sophie's Center is an East County vocational day program for more than 400 adults with developmental disabilities. The brunch features a springtime ambiance at the center's own organic garden, food and beverages from over 20 local restaurants, artwork from St. Madeline Sophie's students and local artists, live music and entertainment on multiple stages, cooking demonstrations, boutique shopping, and the annual Great Frog Race. On Saturday, April 12th, the Wine and Cheese Trail Ride begins at 10 a.m. at the Camp Lockett Event and Equestrian Facility in Campo. Participants can experience a trail ride with a wine and cheese tasting at trail's end. The trail ride includes a tour of Gloriosa Vineyard, heavy hors d'oeuvres, and wine tastings. Sign-ups on site begin at 9 a.m., with the ride starting at 10 a.m. Camp Lockett Event and Equestrian Facility is located on Forest Gate Road in Campo. It is a former Army base that was once the last station of the famous Buffalo Soldiers. Saturday, April 12th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. is the day for the Hamul Kiwanis Hot Rod Show and Chili Cook-Off, with an all-class car show and chili cook-off with raffle prizes, food, live band and DJ, and children's play area at Pio Pico Thousand Trails on Otay Lakes Road in Hamul. Information on how and where to enter your chili, as well as antique vehicle registration, T-shirt orders, and more can be found on HamulKiwanis.com and our East County Magazine calendar. Proceeds for this event fund the Hamul Kiwanis Scholarship Program. The Easter Bunny will be available for the kids at the outlets at Viejas on Saturday and Sunday, April 12th and 13th, from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. The outlets at Viejas are located on Willows Road in Alpine. The fourth annual College Area Taste will be held on Sunday, April 13th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., and will be showcasing over 20 diverse dining destinations in the college area. The Old Town Trolley will be there to assist tasters needing a lift from one area to the next. Tickets to the fourth annual College Area Taste can be purchased in advance or on the day of the event. The German-American Societies of El Cajon are having a special musical event on Saturday, April 12th, with special guest star Andy, a well-known folk singer of music and television in Germany. There will be 4 hours of entertainment and dancing, along with a sausage dinner. The event will be held from 6 to 10 p.m. at the German-American Society on South Mollison Avenue in El Cajon. Now for a preview of some upcoming East County events, including some events for Easter. The Cottonwood Golf Club is featuring a champagne Easter brunch in their pavilion and spring gardens with lake views on Sunday, April 20th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. The brunch includes meat carving stations, a waffle station, entrees, dessert offerings, and much more. For more information, including the complete menu and to book reservations, contact the Cottonwood Golf Club at cottonwoodgolf.com. Saturday, April 19th is the last day to ride the Bunny Train, a real train out at the Campo Depot and Pacific Southwest Railway Museum. The Bunny Train has lots of Easter eggs and fun craft activities for the kids. Trains depart Campo Depot at 11 a.m. and 2:30 p.m., for a scenic one-hour round-trip journey through the mountains with the Easter Bunny. Advance reservations are required for this event and can be made at www.psrm.org. The 60th Annual Easter Pancake Breakfast will be held in Alpine on Easter Sunday, April 20th from 7 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. at the Alpine Elementary School Auditorium on Alpine Boulevard in Alpine. For more information, contact the Alpine Chamber of Commerce at www.alpinechamber.com. The 19th Annual East County Garden Tour, put on by the Friends of East County Arts, Inc., takes place on Saturday, April 26th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. All six gardens offer a variety of settings to learn from and enjoy. Tickets for the 19th Annual Garden Tour are available in advance or at any garden site the day of the tour. Advanced tickets can be purchased on www.friendsofecarts.org. A Beekeeping for Fun and Health workshop will be offered at the Alpine Branch of the San Diego County Library System on Thursday, April 17th at 6 p.m. All ages are welcome. The address of the Alpine Library is on Arnold Way in Alpine, California. That's all for this week. Destination East County is brought to you by our listeners and a community enhancement grant from San Diego County. All of these events and more can be found on our calendar and in our festivals and events section on our website, www.eastcountymagazine.org. See you around, East County!
You're listening to the Voices of East County Magazine, on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson.
And today we're on the road in Lakeside, California, a town that reflects our region's colorful Western frontier heritage as well as Native American history.
The Kumeyaay Indians traced their history here back more than 12,000 years. At the Barona Cultural Center and Museum on Wildcat Canyon Road, you can learn about the rich cultural heritage of the Kumeyaay people and view ancient artifacts. On the Barona Reservation, an annual powwow is held each year in late summer where visitors can see traditional Native American dancing, bird singing, and drumming. The Barona Reservation is also home to the Barona Casino, Resort, and Golf Course.
And now I'm here with Bonnie LaChapa, who is co-chair of the Barona Museum and Cultural Center and who helped head up and organize last year's Barona Powwow. Bonnie, tell us what powwow visitors can expect to see and hear.
You will be amazed by the drums and the Indian songs that they sing. It's very moving. We make sure that the drums are super loud. We have, you know, a lot of speakers, and you'll get a full feel of what it's like for you to be in that whole feeling of the drums. It almost makes your heart just, you know, jump out of your chest. And grand entry is amazing. You'll see all of the dance categories will come in and proceed into the main arena, and they'll dance around the drum, and you'll see all the groups. There's fancy dance, straight dance, shawl, jingle, and you'll see all ages, and it's amazing.
Now, can you tell us, for the non-Native Americans that are listening, the significance of some of the dances that people will be seeing?
The fancy dance would be more like a war dance, something like traditional, like going to war, and the fancy dancers are the real fast ones, the ones that you might be more familiar with on TV. And they have two bustles on their back, and the bustles are what the feathers are attached to. And then you have straight dancers that just have the single bustle, and they move in a slower beat, a slower drum. And we have the grass dancers, who are their regalia is made of a lot of yarn or ribbon, and they were called in to trample down the grass before a powwow or an event. We have jingle dancers are the females, and they make a wonderful jingle noise.
With bells on the costumes.
Bells on the costumes. When I was a girl, the girls weren't allowed to do fancy dance.
Really?
But so then I think as time grew on, and some of the girls wanted to do like a fancy dance, so an Indian woman, this is the story I've been told, had a vision of a butterfly dancing in the wind and moving around, and the movement of that butterfly gave her an idea to create a fancy shawl so the women can do a fancy shawl dress dance that is very fast and upbeat and
beautiful. And I've seen that done. It's quite amazing. This is a wonderful opportunity to look at some of the vendors that come. You have all kinds of Native American crafts, foods.
Last year we had 60 vendors, arts and craft vendors, and then we had 15 informational booths. And we had 13 food booths.
Many of these are Native American crafts, specifically the people that make the Indian jewelry.
And we have arts and crafts people coming from Arizona, from Oklahoma.
Yeah, I've seen dolls and the moccasins and all kinds
to sell their wares. This is some beautiful artwork. We've been around a long time. We were hunter-gatherers. You know, we traveled from the desert to the mountains to the sea. There were no borders. I actually have Kumeyaay family just right across the border that still speak our language, and we've been here a long time. If you ever want to learn more about the Native Indians here, especially my tribe, we have a museum that's open to the public Tuesday through Saturday from 11 to 5 every day.
And it's a marvelous museum.
It's a small museum, but it's got some really nice exhibits.
Where can people find more information about the powwow and also about the museum?
If you just Google Borona Tribe, it'll take you right to our webpage. You'll learn a little bit about the history of the tribe, what we do in our government, how our government works, because we are a sovereign nation.
Very good. Bonnie, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now, there's a lot more colorful history to Lakeside besides the Native American history. In the 1700s, the Spanish missionaries planted crops in a part of the El Cajon Valley that's now known as Lakeside. Some ranches today trace their roots all the way back to early Spanish land grants, and agriculture remains a vital part of this rural community. During the Victorian era in 1886, the El Cajon Valley Land Company bought up over 6,000 acres around Lindo Lake, which is our region's only naturally occurring lake, although Lakeside has several other beautiful lakes in the vicinity.
The Lakeside Hotel, a Victorian inn, was built, and soon the town became a thriving stop on the new railroad line. There was even a racetrack for horses and automobiles, where millionaires and large crowds came to watch the races. A world speed record was set back in 1907, a mile in just under 52 seconds in Barney Oldfield's Green Dragon race car. But when the track's owner, John Gay, died in 1920, the racetracks were demolished at his wishes. So we can't visit there today, but we do have some other exciting places to see.
Lakeside has long been known as a cowboy town. Wild West movies were once filmed here in the silent movie era. You can still find cowboy bars, honky-tonks, and live country music in Lakeside. Now we're heading out to the Lakeside Rodeo Grounds, where the Lakeside Rodeo is celebrating its 50th anniversary in 2014. Rodeo is a popular sport, drawing large crowds here for events such as the annual Lakeside Rodeo each April and the Bulls Only Rodeo in July. Rodeos began as a way for vaqueros and cowboys to test their skills against each other. But today it's a professional sport, and half the contestants nationwide have never worked on a cattle ranch. We are on the road in Lakeside. Betty Washburn is the media coordinator for the Lakeside Rodeo. Tell us about the history of rodeos for listeners who may not be familiar with the sport. How did it all get started?
Well, the sport of rodeo wasn't a sport. It was actual gentlemen on their ranches and stuff rounding up their cattle and branding them, and they had to break horses, so saddle bronc riding started and bareback riding started that way. It was part of the ranching culture that you had to do these things, and then it came about that, this would be fun if we competed doing that. So they went into, on ranches and stuff, all the hands would get together and kind of compete doing that. Ranch against ranch, and then it got bigger and bigger, county against county. So rodeo actually came out of ranching.
Now tell us about the Lakeside Rodeo, how and when this one got started, which today is run by the El Capitan Stadium Association.
Yes. The El Capitan Stadium Association was actually formed by a group of parents, teachers, and administrators up at the El Capitan High School, and they wanted to build a football field. So the parents and everyone got together, and they needed to raise money. And the school district had just built another high school, so they didn't have a lot of money to do that. So a gentleman came forward and said, maybe we could put on a rodeo. Lakeside has had rodeos before. They've been fairly successful. Maybe we could do that. So they rented some ground. They rented some arena fixtures, some bleachers, and rodeo chutes and stuff. and put on their first rodeo in 1964. And it was successful. So they did it again in 1965, and then it grew from there. And then in 1969, a very generous lady happened to have this piece of property that we're sitting on now, and she donated it to the El Capitan Stadium Association.
Nice.
As long as this land was used for the benefit of the youth of Lakeside. So that's what we do.
Marvelous. So, yeah, you benefit a lot of the youth of Lakeside. Tell us some of the organizations.
We do.
The rodeo helps.
Well, the El Capitan High School, of course, Lakeside Union School District. We do the National and Little Leagues, Pop Warner Football. We've helped build the Boys and Girls Club. Almost all the school extracurricular events come to us for funding.
That's great.
We do 4-H, we do FFA. We actually lease part of the grounds behind us for the Eastern San Diego County Junior Fair, which is in May.
Nice. Now, the big rodeo here, the Lakeside Rodeo, is held every year in late April. And as always in recent years, it's part of a bigger festival called Western Days. So what are the rodeo events that people can expect to see if they come here?
Well, of course, there's bull riding.
Ready, here. All right. Stay back, fellas. Well back.
That's Cliff Van Der Kamp, Far Valley.
How long is considered a long time to ride that bull?
Well, 8 seconds is the time that you want to stay on the bull in order to be able to collect any money. And that's the working time of that animal. So that animal gets to work 8 seconds, and then he goes back to his pen and relaxes.
What are the other events?
There's bareback riding. There's saddle bronc riding. There's tie-down calf roping. There's team roping, which is two gentlemen trying to rope a steer. There's still wrestling. And then, of course, there's bull riding. And then we have the ladies' event, which is barrel racing.
Yeah. Now, one thinks of rodeo as being sort of the ultimate macho, manly sport, but it sounds like it's changed through the years.
Everything evolves. So the big events like bull riding and the saddle bronc riding and all the rough stocks is predominantly men-based. There are a few women who join in the team roping, and then, of course, there's the barrel racing, which is almost all women.
Now, Betty, I understand there's one more event that's rather unusual, that's kind of a specialty that's evolved here.
We include the kids in our rodeo. So we have a stick horse race for children from 3 to 6 years old.
Cute.
They sign up when they come in the front gate, and then somewhere around the middle of the performance, they're called out. And they come down to the arena. They're issued a horse, a stick horse, of course. Mm-hmm. But they're issued their horse. And then they're lined up. And then they get to race to the other end of the arena and
get
back.
Up.
And to be honest, every child gets a prize.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
We make sure that our animals that are used here are strictly taken care of by the PRCA rules. And, of course, Mr. Growney and Mr. Kish, who are the owners of the animals, they are very strict about what's taken, how they're taken care of and what's done with them.
Yeah, I imagine it takes special breeding to raise some of these champion animals, the bull riding and
it does.
Bucking broncos and so forth.
It does. Mr. Growney and Mr. Kish have a couple of different ranches where they specialize in breeding and raising the bronc horses along with the bulls. And some of their bulls have been nationally known and are very, very, very well known throughout the community of rodeo. They've had one bull that's never been ridden. So he's a very, very expensive bull, because if you don't ride him, you don't get money. And they do. So that's kind of the deal. And mostly the goal of these animals are to go to NFR, just like with the cowboys. Mm-hmm. So the better they perform throughout the year, the harder they are to ride, the better chance they are to go to NFR.
Interesting. Well, there you go. So this is a proud Lakeside tradition.
It is. Rodeo actually started in Lakeside in the early 1900s. There were some years that we didn't have rodeo. Mm-hmm. And then in the 30s and 40s, it became prominent again. And this association has promoted this rodeo and done this rodeo for the last 50 years.
This is Leon Thompson. I'm here with the executive director of the Lakeside Chamber of Commerce, Kathy Cassell. Welcome.
Good morning.
Certainly, people think of Lakeside as a sort of a Wild West town.
We do have a Western heritage, that's true.
And coming up, you have Western Days.
Yes. April kicks off Western Days, where we do celebrate our uniqueness, and that we will be hosting our 50th annual Lakeside Rodeo. And we kick those off on April 18th with the Lakeside Optimist is hosting a barbecue at the rodeo grounds. On the 24th, there is a cowboy gathering, meet and greet at Pivot Coffee Shop, which is on Main. On the 22nd, there's a chuck wagon dinner at Lakeside Middle Schools, and all of Lakeside Union Schools are participating. The rodeo is kicked off on the 25th in the evening at 7:30. The Lakeside Chamber hosts, it'll be our 49th annual Western Days Parade, 9:30 a.m. on Saturday, the 26th. And then the rodeo has two performances on Saturday. And on Sunday, they have their final performance.
And there's also, I was interested in this, a cowboy poetry.
Yes, there's a couple gentlemen that come out and do kind of a meet and greet. They entertain with cowboy poetry and music.
And what else?
And then on Sunday is the Cowboy Church, which is at the rodeo grounds at 9 a.m.
And what is beans and beer?
In the fall, the Lakeside Chamber puts on a chili cook-off, and we call it Beans, Beers, and Business. And so we have our chili cook-off, our East County breweries, and then, of course, we celebrate all the businesses in East County.
And, you know, downtown Lakeside is quite unique. The architecture harkens back to a Victorian time. It kind of reminds you of a Western town. And so what else are they doing with this can-do spirit to build up Lakeside?
Well, I think you're going to see a lot of the buildings are being remodeled and brought back to life. Some new businesses are coming to Maine.
And you also have an old theater.
Yes, there is a company, a coastal company, that just recently moved in and remodeled the northern half of the building. And my understanding, they'll soon be working on the theater itself and plan to try to preserve as much of the history as possible of the building, but also make it a viable business.
All right. Well, thank you so much for all of this information about Lakeside and its redevelopment in our On the Road in Lakeside segment. And we've been here with Kathy Castle, who is the director of the Lakeside Chamber. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
As San Diego grew, reservoirs were built to meet the region's water needs. Today, three of the most beautiful reservoirs in our region are right here in Lakeside: Lake Jennings, the San Vicente Reservoir, and El Capitan Reservoir. The latter is named for a soaring rocky precipice that resembles the famous El Capitan Mountain in Yosemite National Park. Residents and visitors enjoy fishing, hiking, and in some areas, camping. If you're lucky, you may spy a bald eagle or a bobcat here. Lakeside also has many other parks and nature preserves, places for avid hikers, picnickers, and rock climbers, some with ranger-led activities. In addition, the Lakeside River Park Conservancy has been working to create a network of trails for hiking, biking, and horseback riding along the banks of the San Diego River. The dream is for the San Diego River Park to someday stretch all the way from the mountains to the sea.
Now we're here with Robin Reardon, and Robin is the executive director of the Lakeside River Park Conservancy, and she's here to tell you about some big plans, big changes, and big dreams along the San Diego River out in Lakeside.
Thank you, Miriam. We do have big plans in Lakeside, and lots of great big things are happening. We are in the process of restoring the San Diego River, and our goal is to restore the river from the base of El Capitan Dam all the way to the edge of Santee. And when we restore a river, we restore it for habitat purposes, we restore it for water quality purposes, we also restore it for flood control purposes. So we have done 100 acres in the middle of Lakeside, and we've built a trail along that. We are just about to embark on another nearly 100-acre project in the El Monte Valley at the Hanson-El Monte Pond, and we'll be reconnecting a mining pond to the river. We're going to be developing a trail and then developing habitat all around that pond. It's going to be something really pretty spectacular.
That sounds very exciting. Now, if listeners out there want to come out and see a portion of the trail, maybe they're hikers or they've got horses or they like bicycle riding, where can they go?
Lakeside is a hidden gem. People don't know how beautiful it is and what's available out here. If they come and want to do a nice short, flat hike. They can go to two locations. One is at the Lakeside Baseball Park on Memorial Drive in Lakeside, and they can park there and then take the new half-mile trail segment. Or they can come and park at Channel Road just past the bridge, and they can take a mile-long trail segment. But there are other trails in Lakeside that are really more challenging and take you into areas that are really very interesting. One is the Flume Trail that has been constructed and is being extended right now. To do that, you have to go to El Monte Park, which is at the far eastern end of the El Monte Valley, and look for the trail. It's going to take you way up some switchbacks. But when you get to the right elevation, you are going to be on the old Flume Trail that was cut out along the sides of the mountains to bring water from Cuyamaca Lake down into San Diego in about 1880, somewhere in there. One of the things that I'm really excited about is the new homes property that's being opened up on El Capitan Mountain, or El Cajon Mountain as it's officially known. It's hard to describe how to get there, but the gate is finally open. It's about 500 acres. You can hike up this road and then get to the top of El Cajon Mountain, see El Capitan Reservoir on one side, and really explore a beautiful piece of property that hasn't been open to the public for about 40 years.
That sounds very exciting. So it isn't just trails right along the river, but some things that are up on the ridges and way up high there. Now, I imagine these are pretty wildlife-rich areas. Tell us about some of the animals and birds and unusual things that people might be able to see.
You can see all kinds of animals. California quail is what everyone has a lot of fun with because they're just so cute. But it's not unusual to see coyotes during the day. It's not unusual to see golden weasels during the day. There are golden eagles up near El Capitan Mountain that people can see, but you have to be very careful not to go too close. Bobcats you can see for sure. Roadrunners, all kinds of snakes like glossy snakes, plenty of rattlesnakes. San Diego horned lizards, famously known as horny toads. All kinds of songbirds and waterbirds. What people don't realize is that we're on the Pacific Flyway, so we get all kinds of migrants moving north and moving south in the various seasons. So it's not unusual periodically to see a robin. And oftentimes, if you keep your eyes open, they'll just be traveling through for the day. Some of the birds stay. Some of the really beautiful birds around here are vermilion flycatchers that look like flying rubies, and then lazuli buntings, which are just the most brilliant blue. People don't really think we have amazingly colorful birds when they look at the normal native birds that they see, because they all sort of look like your basic brown bird. But we do have some pretty spectacular ones.
Wow, well, I'm looking forward to hitting the trail out there and trying to see some of these gorgeous birds. And of course, water birds too. I know I've seen herons and egrets out there as well. Now, I understand this is part of a broader vision of trails for the entire San Diego region. Can you please share with our listeners what the ultimate long-term goal is here?
As part of the San Diego River, we are part of a group of organizations that are interested in creating a 52-mile-long trail that will take people from the headwaters up in Julian all the way down to Dog Beach. The trail that is going to be east of El Capitan Mountain is going to be a much more rugged trail designed for hikers and people who really are familiar with the outdoors and can carry sufficient quantities of water to keep them safe as they do it. But the trail that is west of El Capitan Dam, when it's eventually developed, will be primarily flat, very safe, and available for hikers, bikers, equestrians, and moms with strollers. It's going to be a really incredible thing for this community.
So we live in a dry climate here in San Diego, especially East County, and I know that at some times of the year the river will run dry or it'll go underground and you can't see it. When is the best time for people to come and visit?
I think the very best time to come and visit is in the spring. Along our trail, but more importantly, along some of the more naturalized trails in the El Monte Valley, people will get to see wildflowers that they haven't seen before. San Diegans are so wedded to their cars that they really don't see the wildflowers when the hills turn green because they're smaller. Sometimes they're belly flowers that you need to sort of really creep along your belly to see. But if you go up on the Flume Trail in the spring,
It's a paradise up there. It's just stunning with all those flowers.
Wonderful. So you want to wait until there's been some heavy rains and then come on out and see all those gorgeous colors. If the hills are green, the flowers are there.
So if people want to get more information about the Lakeside River Park Conservancy, the trails, or any events that you may have coming up in the future, where can they find that information?
The best way to do it is to go to www.lakesideriverpark.org and sign up for our e-newsletter. It's free. We publish it monthly, and in it, it shows all kinds of activities that are going on in our community and events.
Well, Leon, I think we need to go do some exploring along the San Diego River Trail out here.
I've got my hiking boots on.
Lakeside also has a historic downtown district where you can see storefronts dating back to the 1800s and a historic church that is now home to the Lakeside Historical Society, with a museum right next door. Each year, Lakeside celebrates its historical heritage with some big events. These include the Lakeside Western Days Parade in late April and the Spirit of Christmas on Main Street each holiday season. They also host a Beans, Beer, and Business Expo, complete with Wild West shootouts by Western reenactors.
In 2003, the Lakeside community was devastated by the Cedar Fire, which killed 14 Lakeside residents and burned down countless homes in what still stands as the worst wildfire in California's history. But a decade later, the community has largely risen from the ashes to rebuild, proving the resilience of Lakeside's people, who have forged stronger bonds, neighbors helping neighbors, keeping true to the frontier spirit of Lakeside's past. So tell me, Kathy, what is it that's so special about Lakeside?
There's lots of things that are special about Lakeside. For me, it's about the people. I think Lakeside is full of people who support each other, neighbors who help neighbors without even being asked.
Yes, and that was quite evident after the Cedar Fire, a town that was really devastated. You can't talk about the history of Lakeside without mentioning the worst wildfire in California's history.
Yes.
And it's a town that seems to be united and have its own character or personality. So this do-it spirit of Lakeside has resulted in Lakeside coming back from the ashes, which is well spoken of in your license plate on your car is...
Yes, my license plate says the Phoenix, risen from the ashes. And I think it's a sample of, or example of, the Lakeside spirit, in that we just worked together, we worked hard, and we came back bigger and better.
We'll be back soon for another adventure on the road in East County. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.